This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio
Free
Radio.
This is Misrepresent, behind the face of fierce woman. Laura Kramer is the artistic director and choreographer of Laura Kramer Dance based in Montreal. Laura is a First Nations dancer and choreographer whose work is linked to memory and her Aboriginal roots. Her work examines political issues surrounding Canada and First Nations people. For this episode of Misrepresent, behind the face of fierce woman, Laura discusses her latest creation, Native Girl Syndrome, addiction, the legacy of residential schools, and her grandmother who inspired the piece. Due to poor internet connections, portions of the podcast may be inaudible.
So my initial inspiration for the work came from wanting to further investigate my grandmother's experience. She had migrated from a small community in northern Ontario and wound up living on the streets in Winnipeg. What led her to having, you know, a life on the streets? My partner and I, we walked through East Van, and he was more or less giving me a tour of the area. And I actually also had an old high school friend. She works in East Van with a lot of grassroots organizations. And so I think for me, it was really understanding from her was the cycle of addiction and a lot of the aspects that contribute to that reality. It's hard to pick such an actual starting point because it was definitely sort of in the back of my head for a few years. Like, well, even when I was doing the work on residential schools, that's where I fell across the term Native Girl Syndrome. And I mean, there was a point early in my process. It was quite form-based, coming from, you know, my background in dance and what I'm sort of used to, I guess, vocabulary I'm used to using in choreography, movement, and a certain physicality. But there was a turning point because I felt that wasn't somehow justified, or I guess I also didn't feel I wanted to do sort of a poetic version of my grandmother's story or work with, I guess, abstract form to depict addiction. Mm-hmm. So there's a turning point where I just felt that, okay, I need to go in something that's a little more realistic. And I really stripped it down. And I started working a lot more with the dancers or performers, doing these lead improvs and really trying to get them to create these internal universes and understand for themselves how does the state of addiction feel in the body or where does it resonate. And I do remember that really coming out of my experience of walking down these tastings and realizing that, like, it never stops. Like, there's not a moment, you know, daytime is just as potent or intense as nighttime there. It's not this thing where, you know, an addict sleeps because it's nighttime or a certain point in the day, but it's constantly in your face. I wanted to also remove, like, this idea of blackouts or interrupting the scene, like, where I've gotten in a little more of a traditional sense of my work. It's really forcing the audience to address these characters or confront them in a sense. Pacing was so important. Like, there were moments where I was like, wow, this is really, like, you know, even for example, the beginning, you know, where I feel what they're doing is intricate, but it's quite stretched, you know, just that moment as I'm pushing the buggies. They're quite static for a while. The way to manipulate time and get the audience kind of to settle in. I definitely see how this work challenges the norm of what is contemporary dance. During the process, I never felt this pressure that, oh, I need to achieve a certain style or, you know, have a certain amount of movement flowing to keep my audience awaits. Like sometimes there's these moments that just seem, okay, well, it's not like pop culture or Hollywood entertainment, but it's really looking into something that's maybe a little more accurate. You know, it's definitely not a good show, right?
No.
It's not a work where you're walking away feeling, you know, warm or probably even inspired, but it's heavy. And I think, you know, another element of my research was, you know, I went up north to revisit where my grandmother came from, the reserve she was at. And I think up there too, I really felt this like intensity of you know, what's happened not only to my family, but the effects of residential school for you know, most First Nations people in Canada are you know, long term. And I it's funny because Native Girl Syndrome, it wasn't about residential schools, but I really look at I see now how that early experience, my grandma's life, sort of influenced a lot of her choices and really fragmented her from her family and from her, you know, cultural understanding of home. And you know, I think it's her experience with that definitely, I think, affected her, the outcome. I've definitely been asked that a few times, you know, if I was going to leave the audience with some hope or even with these characters. And it's, you know, for me, there's maybe a little moment of it, you know, in the work, but it doesn't last long. And it's when the one character, you know, she has this monologue with this exterior person named Jenny. And, you know, and for me, it felt like an appropriate amount of hope in the sense of, oh, maybe today's the day she's going to, you know, get her shit together and sober up and you know, pull up her socks kind of thing. And the cycles of addiction and long-term effects of residential schools and abuse, and it's not, they're not easy to break. And so I think for me it was, you know, this character was confronted and by a certain level of maybe judgment or shame of not having her children with her. And I think, you know, in truth, you know, if I had children ripped away from me, it'd be very difficult to get over that, you know. And so for me, that character in that moment, we were just, you know, we contemplated different outcomes.
This is Misrepresent, Behind the Face of Fierce Woman.